Anyone come to order? Members, I think we have a quorum. I don't know if anyone's had a chance to glance at the minutes yet.
Madam Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Representative Munson moves the minutes of March 6. Are there any changes or corrections? All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? Those minutes are approved. Members, we're waiting for our testifier for our first two bills, and so we're going to jump down to House File 2017. Oh, he just stepped in now. Should we go with our regular order?
That's fine. Madam Chair, I'm fine either way.
Okay, let's go with the regular order. So we'll stick with 1571. Representative Howard, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 1571 before the committee and make a motion for re-referral to the Commerce Committee.
And members, we have a gentleman at the testifying table who got a little publicity.
Madam Chair, would it be okay if I first move the A1 amendment just
Absolutely.
To get the bill?
There's an author's amendment. Yeah. So Representative Howard has moved House File 1571, and he has moved the author's amendment A1 to get the bill before us in the form that the author would like. Anything further to that before? Author's amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That amendment has been attached. And members, before we, I just have to, I've got my little publicity piece here. The gentleman sitting at the table got some great publicity in the Sunday Star Tribune. I would encourage you all to look that up, because he cites in the Q&A some Wilder Foundation research, which is, I think, very helpful for us to understand the current time. His quote as a caption sets a context for some of the challenges our committee faces. Decades of converging economic, market, social, and policy trends are pushing us towards 20 years of the worst housing situation for lower-income households since the Great Depression. And I've been a fan of this testifier because he's an expert at identifying naturally occurring affordable housing and trying to save as many of them as he can. So we're delighted to have him. So Representative Howard, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this bill is squarely in the realm of preserving and improving affordable housing in the area of our manufactured home communities. You know, we have roughly 800 to 1,000 home parks in Minnesota, none that are new since the 1990s. There's 50,000 owners of their or occupants of the manufactured homes, making it the largest source of affordable home ownership in the state. But we've seen in years many of those parks go away for redevelopment purposes. And when we lose that housing, it's gone for good. That's when we're not, you know, replacing it. And so this bill has to do with our right to first refusal law. Minnesota is a right to refusal state, where we encourage park owners to sell their communities to the homeowners. In Minnesota, if a park community is being sold for redevelopment, residents or an authorized nonprofit are given 45 days to meet the same term and conditions as the developer. And unfortunately, we've seen in recent years that process has some loopholes and barriers that have worked against homeowners and have led to displacement of Minnesotans. And so that's really the genesis of this bill, to look at closing some of those barriers and loopholes so that we can do what we can to make sure that our home park communities are staying in the hands of our residents. And I will turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Arthur, who can talk about how this really fits into the broad scheme of our work in Minnesota to preserve affordable housing and address our affordable housing crisis. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Question before the testifier?
No, I'll
ask you. Welcome, committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Alan Arthur, and I'm the president and CEO of Aon. We're a nonprofit developer, owner, and manager of affordable apartment housing in the state of Minnesota, the Twin Cities, really. We've been around 33 years, and I always cringe a little bit when somebody calls me an expert. It just means you've been around a long time, which means I'm getting older, and that's not necessarily a really good thing. But thank you, and I was a little embarrassed by the photo in the newspaper, and I got a lot of ribbing about it as well. So I'm in support of the first right of refusal from manufactured home parts for a really fairly simple reason, that it provides some of the most affordable homes in our state for some of the folks who have the most difficulty finding a place to live. So the fundamental question I think we have, Madam Chair, committee members, is do we care? Do we care if people in our communities have a place to live? As Chairperson Hausman mentioned, I think we are headed towards 20 years of the worst housing problems for lower-income people since the Great Depression in the 1930s. There's a whole bunch of reasons for that. The word NOAA was mentioned, naturally occurring affordable housing. We've been losing it at upwards of 100 units a week in the Twin Cities. People at the lower incomes are making 15% less than they made in 2010. The marketplace is extremely hot. We're a very diverse and strong economy, and that leads to rental real estate being a very desired commodity. The federal government has backed away from affordable housing since the mid-80s, although it may not seem like it to some people. But we've grown as a country since that time from 240 million people to 318 million people. So all those things put together mean we're headed towards where we're headed right now, a very tough place. I believe homelessness is going to double. We've done a great job in the state of Minnesota actually combating homelessness. It's actually gone down a little bit in the last few years, but I don't think it will continue to do so. The fastest growing population of homelessness in our communities are seniors. 30% of seniors are below the poverty level. We will be stepping over the bodies of seniors when we come into our businesses in the morning and go to work. Is that some crazy prediction? No. I'm just talking about what's happening in every other major city in the country. We're just the last one to see it. 10 years ago, that didn't happen in Seattle. That didn't happen in Portland. 25 years ago, it happened in Los Angeles and San Francisco. But now it's in Portland. Now it's in Seattle. They've lost all of their naturally occurring affordable housing. So that's where we're headed, and we cannot afford any more losses. We are not able to build our way fast enough to make up for the losses that we've had after 35 years of underproducing housing of all kinds, actually, including affordable places for people to live in our community. So the first right of refusal does a simple thing. It just gives us the opportunity, gives the residents an opportunity to step in and save their affordability, save their homes for themselves, their families. A large chunk of the mobile home parks we've looked at and considered buying are a large number of folks there are seniors on fixed incomes. The other large group of folks there are folks working to clean these floors here at the office building after we go home at night. Folks who we need to do the work in our communities to keep our economy strong. So that possibility to save this precious resource is extremely important as a tool in the toolbox for our residents and folks like Aon to help preserve affordable places for people to call home in our community. So it's just a simple request to make the chance for us to do that easier and better and more likely, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you very much.
And Representative Howard, you have three other testifiers, is that correct? Who would you like to?
Next, I have David Anderson from
Aon. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Anderson. I'm the Executive Director of All Parks Alliance for Change, APAC. It's a statewide association of manufactured homeowners. And I was going to just provide an overview of the proposal and a little bit of an explanation for it. So the right of first refusal applies to the few parks sold each year for redevelopment. That's specifically what it's oriented towards. It allows 45 days to match the developer's offer. As amended, and this is in the A1 amendment, the proposal keeps the original 45-day period. It doesn't expand it to 60 days. It clarifies some of the issues that have been unclear in the use of the right of first refusal. For example, when do the terms and conditions need to be provided immediately? When can a purchase agreement be entered into after the 45 days? What does it mean to be a representative acting on behalf of residents? There's a decision or the definition that clarifies that that's in the A1 amendment. What does it mean to meet the terms and conditions? It clarifies that it's the material terms and conditions. For example, purchasing a park to close it can't be a condition that the residents have to meet. What due diligence period is allowed for, just one that's commercially reasonable. It also allows, and this language is in the A1 amendment, residents to request the notice in an alternative format, so if you have a disability or if you need it in another language. It also goes towards simplifying and clarifying the process overall. The subdivision, in subdivision 7, there's actually what's essentially a second right of first refusal. If the developer fails to provide notice of their intent to convert the property, and it simplifies it, it eliminates that second right of first refusal and just simply requires notice. If that notice hasn't been provided, that the developer wait the 12 months that would be required otherwise, having purchased the community to provide the notice. And it does things to specifically address problems that came up in the case of the Lowry Grove community that Mr. Arthur's organization, Aon, worked with the residents to attempt to purchase, including eliminating a requirement that notice be provided to the county that a property that's already licensed annually to operate as a manufactured home park is, in fact, operating as a manufactured home park. This is a notice that doesn't have any purpose outside of this statute. Clarifies that an affidavit of compliance should be filed by the purchaser, as opposed to, in one case in the legislation, it talks rather vaguely about a person with knowledge. And it also goes to an issue that was significantly impactful on the residents' attempt to purchase the community, which was in the case of Lowry Grove, the residents met their requirement within the allotted time to match the terms and conditions. Unfortunately, the landowner went ahead with a sale to the developer. That was identified clearly in litigation as an illegal act. Unfortunately, the statute doesn't provide as a remedy the residents being able to halt a sale once it's been identified as illegal. The way the statute currently reads, the landowner ignoring a matching offer provided in the amount of time allowed and just simply going ahead with the sale to the developer actually terminates the resident's right to purchase the property, which goes obviously against the spirit and intent of the law. In summary, the changes proposed in the bill and the A1 amendment, they don't do anything to increase the footprint of the right of first refusal. It's the same right governed by the same circumstances as it has been. It just simply allows it to operate as intended. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And we have two more testifiers. Antonio Alvarez. Who is a Lowry Grove resident. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. We have somebody else joining us there.
Buenos dias.
Good morning.
Mi nombre es Antonia Alvarez.
My name is Antonia Alvarez.
Yo viví en, soy parte de la Asociación de Residentes de Lowry Grove.
I am a member of the Resident Association at Lowry Grove.
Y estoy aquí porque El impacto negativo que pasó con los residentes de Lowry Grove aún lo seguimos sintiendo.
And I am here because of the negative impact of the things that took place at Lowry Grove. I'm still experiencing and going through that.
Anoche tuvimos una reunión con los residentes y llegan alrededor de 25 o 30 familias.
We had a meeting with the residents yesterday and 25 or up to 30 families still show up.
Y no hay una puerta de salida o de esperanza cuando se pierde un parque o un parque de casas móviles.
And there's not really an exit towards happiness or stability when you lose a mobile home community.
Nosotros perdimos un residente que se suicidó por no tener opción a dónde ir a vivir.
We even had one of the residents, we lost him to suicide because he didn't have anywhere else to go.
Muchos de aquí o algunos de aquí son del Partido Republicano y hablan de que son pro vida.
Some folks here are affiliated with the Republican Party and I believe you consider yourself to be pro-life.
Yo soy una mujer de fe, soy una mujer católica y yo soy pro-vida.
I am a woman of faith, I practice Catholicism and I am pro-life.
Para mí pro-vida no solamente es proteger de nuestros bebés antes del nacimiento, sino proteger de todo un pueblo.
For me, being pro-life does not only mean to protect the life of a baby who hasn't been born yet, but is to protect the whole city.
La gente que no tiene un lugar a donde ir a vivir no merece morir en estas circunstancias.
People that don't have anywhere else to go do not deserve to die under these circumstances.
Solamente quiero recordarles que la avaricia no nos lleva a la gloria de Dios.
I just want to remind you that greed does not let us into God's glory.
Quiero decirles que queremos una oportunidad para salvar nuestros parques.
I want to tell you that we want an opportunity to be able to save our communities, our parks.
Quiero pedir de ustedes que la historia de Lowry Grove no permitan que se vuelva a revivir.
I want to ask all of you that Lowry Grove's story does not repeat itself again.
Quiero pedir a ustedes un poco de compasión, un poco de amor, un poco de sabiduría para que esto que está pasando en todo el estado de Minnesota lo frenemos, los abusos en los parques los frenemos, que pensemos en la humanidad de los seres humanos.
Today I ask for a little bit of your compassion, a little bit of love, for you to think about those folks who continue to be abused and for us to be able to work to stop that, for us to be able to work together to stop displacement from taking occurring over and over again.
Si no distinguimos entre el reconocer la dignidad de las personas y la ambición y estamos pensando que solamente tratando de enriquecer a algunos pocos y empobreciendo a otros, no vamos a reconocer la dignidad de las personas. No estamos haciendo un buen trabajo. Tenemos que trabajar por la comunidad.
We need to make a difference between recognizing folks' dignity and greed. We need to be intentional about recognizing folks' dignity by having protections. We cannot let greed to take over.
Solamente estoy aquí pidiéndoles justicia. Quiero justicia. Les pido justicia en nombre de los residentes de Lowry Grove, en nombre del sufrimiento del pueblo indocumentado, en nombre de la gente que más necesita representación de cada uno de ustedes. Ese es su trabajo.
I am asking today for justice for justice for the undocumented community who continues to be vulnerable, for those folks who need all of your representation more than anyone else.
Does that conclude your testimony? Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. And we have one more testifier, Ms. Phillips, Executive Director of MICA. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm the Executive Director of MICA, the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, and Vice President of the National Coalition for the Homeless. You have two pieces of paper that were handed out to you that I'm going to just talk briefly about in just a moment. MICA believes that everyone, without exception, needs to have a decent, safe, accessible, and affordable place to call home. We work very hard across the metro area as well as in the state and across the country in being a welcoming community where we treat and love others the way that we want to be treated, which is true in all 13 world religions. All of our sacred writings talk about loving others as ourselves. Manufactured Homes Park, as Alan Arthur mentioned and others mentioned, are our most affordable housing that's available in the community, and we need to keep it affordable. If you just take a moment and you look at the counties in your district, you will see the need for affordable housing in your community and the importance of that. I want to read a couple additional statements from folks that were living the last days that they were at Lowry Grove. This is Bill McConnell. He said, "It was my little American dream come true. Own my own home," as he sat in his trailer in Lowry Grove. He planned to stay in the park until the very last minute. "I'm here until 11:59. I paid my rent until 11:59. I will last it out." Mitchell, another gal that was living in the park, she was in number E13, and that's how she introduced herself. She lived there for 17 days. On the park's closing day, she was sitting in her van, unsure of where she would go next. "I cannot go north, south, east, or west, anywhere. I slept in my car last night." And then, as was mentioned by the previous testifier, if you take a look at this sheet, the very last sheet, you will see that Frank basically said, "This is my home. I'm not going to leave Lowry Grove." And he committed suicide. We can do so much better than this. 97 units of elderly people, of children, of veterans, of our diverse populations lost their homes because of an illegal sale that we did not cover in our law that this bill will amend. So that's 97 units of housing. If we were to build that, that would cost at least $25 million. If you talk to Alan, we could have bought the property. We could have replaced all of the mobile home parks and done a whole new infrastructure in Lowry Grove for $25 million, and everybody would still have a really nice home to live in. So we are just shooting ourselves in the head, basically, in dealing with the housing crisis. I've been working on this for 50 years, and we've had growing homelessness for four decades. So we need to address this issue. And we can do better, and we are doing better in many communities. So I drive by Lowry Grove going to my church to teach Bible study each week. It's still vacant. Nothing's happened there. A year and a half later, almost 2 years later, still sitting vacant. You know, all these folks have been displaced. I live in Fridley. We are the only community in the metro area that has a cooperative-owned mobile home park called Park Plaza. Encourage you to come out at 4 o'clock on Friday and come take a tour of it. It's wonderful. The communities own it. We just put in CDBG dollars to do the infrastructure in the city of Fridley. I bought the house that I grew up in, and so that's just the Park Plaza that's just down the street from where I live, and we are just very excited about the mobile home parks that we have throughout our community. In Anoka County, through our community action program, we actually replace mobile homes as they get older. And certainly we could do this across the state, too. So I'm going to just leave with the author of the bill all of the different units across the state of Minnesota so you can look at your own community where we have this affordable housing right now and where we need to maintain it. Thank you.
And members, that is attached to this particular handout. Representative Howard, to the bill, we have a question. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My first one is on the amendment. I didn't see that there was going to be an amendment to this, which is now part of the bill. You talk about residents in the amendment. So the original bill talked about owners of the mobile homes within the park. and you're changing that language to be residents, and that the person has to get the permission from at least one adult tenant of a property in order to represent them in the purchase, you know, in the first right of purchasing this property. Why did you change it from owner to tenant?
Would that be for Mr. Anderson?
Let me turn that over to Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, that is an error, and it's supposed to be tenant or resident. Is that correct? Sorry. So that's a mistake.
So do we make an oral amendment?
Madam Chair.
Do you have to fix that in Commerce, or do you want
to? Would it be appropriate to just make a technical friendly amendment? It is going to be heard in Commerce on Friday. We could go that route as well. I'm kind of indifferent.
Yeah, I'd like to discuss it because it's not just about changing resident or the other term that you used. It seems like it should be that the owners of the mobile homes within the park should be the ones deciding if they're going to purchase it, not just, you know, if I own three mobile homes in a park, it shouldn't be just up to the tenants to decide if they want to buy the park. I think it should be the owners of the property, or the owners of the mobile homes within the park. But I'm curious why the language changed from owner to resident.
Who can speak to that?
Well, I'll just say I think broadly, and I'd ask Mr. Anderson to weigh in as well, but just adding in sort of inclusive language, and be happy to make that change. But
and I don't know if Mr. Arthur, you're welcome to come to the table again too if you want to be part of the discussion. We have one other question, or
well, I have other questions, but I'd like Representative Pearson to speak to this.
Well, I guess adding the additional component, because I didn't review that part either, and now the fact that for the discussion that it's an error, how does that impact? Aren't there percentage requirements for people to sign up and participate in the process of buying out the mobile home park then also? And so how does that go towards the calculation of, if you have a resident and an owner, do they each get counted in that total, and then everything has to be divided up newly within the percentages that are required for participation?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so it is a complicated situation being a homeowner living in a manufactured home park community, because you are simultaneously a resident, which is defined under state law as someone who owns a home and rents a lot, and a tenant, defined under general tenant-landlord law. This is an attempt to make sure that there's a thorough definition. There is a percentage requirement. But it's limited in terms of by household. So you couldn't attempt to get to the percentage requirement by having multiple individuals within the same household sign to meet that threshold. So if that's the concern, it doesn't create that possibility. That hasn't been the case under existing law. It wouldn't be the case under the proposed language. This is just attempting to capture the complexity of being considered both a resident and a tenant under state law.
Representative Pearson, did you have a follow-up?
I do, yeah. So that contemplates this concept that there's, you know, one lot is going to be one vote then at that point. But again, and I think Representative Munson was alluding to it as well, the house that's on the improvement structure that's on the lot could also be owned by someone else. And so then when do you determine whether it's the landlord of the improvement or the tenant of that improvement that has a voice or a vote?
Mr. Anderson.
Well, that's something that could certainly be looked identified in terms of the records that theoretically the community owner is maintaining in terms of whether any of the homes are ones that they own, that they're renting out to individuals living in those homes as opposed to owned by the occupants themselves. Part of trying to capture the complexity of both being a resident and a tenant is a recognition that those records are not always kept consistently by the community owners in terms of who falls into which category, whether they're an owner occupant or a tenant occupant, if they're renting the home as well and it's not owned by the community itself. So like I said earlier, it's it can be a complex arrangement in parks where as a household you may be wearing multiple hats.
Representative Salk has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not certain who would be the correct person for me to be asking this question of. And this question with a preposition doesn't work. But my question is, what was the original law and what did it intend? Because I know that as we are discussing this, which is a change to law, it's oftentimes anchoring if you understand what the original law was, what it intended in that law, and this question of is it the owner or the resident, and who was to be the recipient of the accrued benefits of the old law. That all helps me then understand the context of what we're trying to move to. So if somebody has that, it would assist me in a big way.
And you're talking about current law. What is current law before
current law before adopted? This would be enacted or taken up?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Salk. So the existing right of first refusal in Minnesota Statute 327C.095 was enacted in 1991. It was a response to the transition that Mr. Arthur was referring to earlier, that and Representative Howard referred to as well, that up until the beginning of the 90s, communities were being created. From that point on, there haven't been, at least in the metro area, and rarely in greater Minnesota, new communities created. Instead, it's been a slow but steady closure of these communities and displacement of the families living in these communities. It's narrowly targeted towards those communities where they're being sold for redevelopment within a year. It's a relatively small number of communities each year, but as you heard from Antonia Alvarez and Sue Watliff Phillips, it may be a small number of communities overall, but for the households that are impacted, it's a tremendously important. Overall, the intent is to make sure that people are able to remain in their homes and in their communities. In most cases, when a community is closed, the homes can't be relocated. So it's not just a matter of the community being lost. It's often the homes themselves that are lost. I hope that answers.
Follow up,
Go ahead. I was getting, Madam Chair, and just to clarify as well, in the bill before us isn't essentially offering wholesale changes to that process, in terms of days and timelines and et cetera. The intent is to keep the process in place. It's just looking at how it's been applied. Are there things to make sure that it can operate as it was intended?
Mr. Arthur, would you?
While he's arriving, maybe, because it's sounding a bit like I'm a little unclear, apparently, or I've lost my ability to communicate exactly what I intend to be asking. The law,
I think I get it,
has a beneficiary for its actions, for its protections. I'm curious as to, either in effect or in intent of the law, who specifically was the recipient of the benefit? Was it the renter, the owner, in terms of that benefit of
be having the first right of refusal to purchase, because those are really two people who have completely different sets of resident rights under most any law that would be protecting residents. But this is a very narrow law. I'm somewhat aware of it. It's just that in my hometown, we haven't had the occurrence of this particular thing to bring it to such focus and light. And that's why I need the benefit of understanding what the law and who was the beneficiary under that law. So,
Mr. Arthur.
Madam Chair, Representative, anybody who reads the law realizes that the purpose of the law was to give the residents the opportunity to save their homes, or a entity on behalf of the residents to help the residents save their homes. There are those who would tell you that the legislators were just kidding, maybe when they passed the law in 1991, but any reasonable reader of the law will say it just wasn't written very well. The purpose of the language that is talked about here is to clean it up so it actually adheres to that original intent that the beneficiaries would be the residents of these homes who would be losing their homes. That's the purpose of the changes being made, and that in my view at least was the purpose of the original law, but couldn't be perfectly carried out or implemented because of the way it read.
So that was the purpose of the law. It didn't quite work in this instance, and based on what you learned from this instance, this bill is before us.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is correct. And yeah, that is correct. Yeah.
Thank you. That was exactly what I was asking for.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to point out on line 2.21 of the bill, it had said the permission of the owners of at least 51% of the manufactured homes. And I would take that to say if you own three or four mobile homes in this park, and a lot of these homes after a period of time can't be moved without destroying the home, this bill may have been written to provide people who had investments in mobile homes the ability to buy the land it was sitting on because they couldn't move the homes. And so I don't know if it was necessarily about protecting residents or protecting the owners of the mobile homes. But either way, we're changing the bill. One of my concerns on this bill is changing from 45 days to 60 days, this notification period.
If you notice, the A1 amendment changed that
back to 45.
Well, it changed only one of them. So it says on line 1.12, it still says 60-day written notice. Are you changing both of them, or is it just the... Because I was going to call that out, too. You have a 60-day written notice that's required on line 1.12, but yet you talk about the 45 days have expired. You're amending it again back to 45. So which is it?
Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, the instruction in the amendment for page 1, line 12, is to reinstate the stricken language and delete the new language, so it does go back to 45 days.
In both places.
In both places.
On lines 112 and 113 of the amendment.
I want to reinstate the stricken language. Oh, okay. So that's going back to 45 days.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So a lot of the purchases that I make and sales are 1031 exchanges, which require 45 days notice given to the IRS to designate which properties that you're going to be purchasing in exchange for your property. Now, even though it's a 45-day notice here, I will, as an owner of a property, I may get a purchase agreement offered to me that says I have to respond within 10 days. This would prevent me from doing that. I have to ask for 45 days, right, and to give my tenants notice to meet that purchase agreement. And what if the purchase agreement says the purchase price is $1 million, but there's a $200,000 earnest money check where the financial contingencies are waived? So in other words, the purchaser has said they're going to put $200,000 down. If they don't qualify for finance, for financing, that they lose their $200,000. You could write a purchase agreement in a way that the owners or tenants of the mobile home park would likely not be able to meet. Is that a way around this law? I mean, are you writing this law to? It basically they have to meet the terms of the purchase agreement. Is that right?
And I should remind you, Representative Munson, this does go to Commerce next, and so there are perhaps appropriate discussions to be had there as well. Yeah. Representative Howard.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, and part of the intent of moving back to the 45 days is to more closely align with current law and to not make wholesale changes. And so the idea is overall to have language that closes loopholes and just makes the the law work as intended.
Okay. And another question. If you're trying to maintain mobile home parks, why not just write into law that when somebody purchases a mobile home park, they can't convert it for 5 years? Or why not just put a longer time period on when they can convert?
Madam Chairperson Munson, I hadn't thought of that idea. I mean, I think it's worthwhile considering multiple avenues at this. This bill, again, is specifically tailored to the current law, and can we make it work a little better? But I'm open to other ideas as well. I think it's an issue that warrants a fair amount of our concern and attention.
Okay. I have no further questions. You have some concluding comments on the bill.
Madam Chair, I want to thank my testifiers. Oh, and I think there is some public testimony as well.
Oh, if we have another testifier. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, Mark Bruner, Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. We're the association that represents the builders of manufactured modular homes as well as the owners of manufactured home park communities. And I'd like to thank Representative Howard for accommodating some of our concerns relative to the bill, reinstating the 51% requirement of residents to participate. And to just follow up on Representative Munson's point about, you know, keeping the manufactured home park a manufactured home park after a right of first refusal is exercised is something that we think is a good idea. We've had conversations and hopefully can come up with a number prior to it stopping the Commerce Committee. One other point in discussing, you know, earnest money, we feel that it's important that there either be a surety bond or some type of earnest money so that if this offer falls through, that the property owner in some way is compensated for any loss of value if they were to sell the property 6 months later at a loss of, you know, $100,000, whatever that might be. So we would like to see some type of a surety bond or earnest money requirement included. And I know, you know, we've talked about that with Representative Howard, and that would be the other issue. And just, you know, to the point of the original intent of the bill or the statute when it was first enacted, I mean, it really was intended to benefit the homeowners, those who are occupants of the manufactured home park, as a way for them to purchase the property. I do think that changing it to tenants and using a definition in 504B simply means that anyone who is an occupant of a dwelling then would have the ability to say that, you know, they want to be a part of this acquisition when in fact they may not own the home. So, you know, perhaps some additional time could be spent on that question as well.
And I know you've been in conversation with the author.
Yes.
Final comments. I think we're concluding with.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the testimony. It is my intent to continue having conversations and working together on this bill and moving forward. My final comment is what really brings me to this work. This bill is what I've seen in our own community with the loss of affordable housing. Not an exactly similar scenario, but as I've mentioned in committee before, when a large apartment complex in our community was flipped, we saw over 1,000 members of our community displaced with huge impact for our community. And as Ms. Alvarez testified, this is really about dignity. And as Mr. Arthur testified, this is about the most efficient way we can tackle our affordable housing crisis. We can't build our way out of this. Preserving our affordable housing is so vital, and I believe this bill is an important step in that direction, and I would ask for your support.
And apparently we do have one more question, Representative Pearson.
Well, and actually I don't know that we ever technically made the correction that we talked about earlier of, and so I think a motion would be in order either from the bill author, since it's his bill and he's on the committee, or someone. Before it goes to Commerce, it should be.
If you can you give us the oral amendment, and then the author could move that if you want to. The error that you pointed out.
Okay. Chair and members, if you want to incorporate this into the amendment you adopted, on the A1 amendment at on page 1, line 8, before the comma, insert or resident.
To the author, is that something you would...
That's satisfactory to me. Yes, Madam Chair.
...be an author's amendment. So he's moving that. Does everybody understand?
No.
Would you repeat that once more, Ms. Mullen?
Page 1 of the amendment, line 8, before the comma, insert or resident.
One adult tenant or resident. That is before us. All in favor, representative? No. To the author after this. That amendment is... What is it? All right, we've got that oral amendment before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, that has been clarified.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Johnson, did you have one more question?
I just had a little bit of concern on the bill. I understand the purpose of this and trying to make sure that the residences aren't displaced or make sure they have an opportunity to move someplace in a orderly fashion if it should end up that way. But with this last amendment we put on with the resident or find that spot, the tenant or the resident, there's a person that's been left out. It's the owner of that home. You could have subleasing three rooms in the trailer you own that you live in, and you want to take no part in it, but somebody that's renting a room from you can outvote you and in this process. I think we do need to look at, make sure that the owner of the home has a say in this and not just somebody renting from them.
I'm looking for someone to step
in. Madam Chair, I'll just say, I think we've talked about this a little bit, but I'm definitely open to having those conversations and trying to make sure that if there's clarifying language to sort of get at this. But I understand the feedback and open to continuing to look at it.
We have no more questions. Would you renew your motion?
Yeah. So moved, Madam Chair.
As amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, you are on your way to Commerce. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we have now Representative Hornstein. And Representative Hornstein, I believe you also are joined by Mr. Arthur.
Yes.
And Kier. But you're also joined by... Ms. Johnson?
Yes.
Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Yes, I would like to move House File 1574 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
That motion is before us. Speaking to the bill.
Thank you, members. And first of all, I'd like to thank Representatives Juergens and her for co-sponsoring this legislation. And thank you, Madam Chair, for a really great experience over these last couple months, learning a lot about our very deep affordable housing crisis in the region. And this bill is really meant to address the need to maximize our existing investments that the state currently makes. You know, we've talked a lot about the need for new investments, but this is really to maximize what we currently do. So the way it works in House File 1574 is that in exchange for public investment in multifamily affordable housing projects, those projects would then have to maintain affordability for a minimum of 30 years. Currently, most of the funding sources administered through Minnesota Housing, including some that we've heard already this session, like the Challenge Program, do require at least 30 years of affordability. However, some only require 15. And so, as you'll hear in a little while from Mr. Arthur, This bill is aimed at preventing displacement. Housing displacement has real consequences on kids, families, and communities. I found that out in work I did prior to being elected. About 20 years ago, I worked in a building called Oak Grove Towers, which just happens to be in the district I represent. And this was a building that was going to be converted. It had a federal subsidy, and many families were very, very worried about being displaced, and as we heard in the previous bill, had literally nowhere to go. And so fortunately, we were able to organize and keep that building affordable, but this is the kind of thing that happens in these kind of short-term situations. And so the bill is about maximizing the state's investments in affordable housing, preventing displacement, and helping communities for the long term. And I'd ask for your support. And I have two testifiers, Madam Chair.
Ms. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Houseman. Members of the committee, my name is Carrie Johnson. I am a policy co-chair for the Homes for All Coalition. And I am the senior policy advisor at MCCD, which represents 30 nonprofit affordable housing developers. Before I get started, I want to thank Representative Hornstein for carrying this bill and for all the committee members that signed on in support as well. I also want to mention that today is Homeless Day on the Hill. There will be roughly 800 affordable housing advocates up here today talking about the importance of supporting the full continuum of affordable housing through the Homes for All's legislative agenda, which includes support for House File 1574. As Representative Hornstein mentioned, House File 1574 would not only help to combat and prevent displacement, but also maximize the state's financial resources. This policy issue has been talked about for a number of years by nonprofit affordable housing developers, which commonly keep affordable housing units permanently affordable for the life of the property. Many times this is much longer than even 30 years. This bill, in tandem with sustainable funding, will help to support affordable housing in communities across the state for the long term. It is my hope, as an affordable housing advocate, that Minnesota can solve its affordability crisis, and if this bill is enacted, could help to ensure that down the road we don't have to continue to have this discussion every 10 to 15 years. In recent years, many, if not all, of the state's financial tools to produce and preserve affordable housing have been heavily oversubscribed. This in particular has been a driver in conversations around support for longer affordability terms from affordable housing advocates and nonprofit affordable housing developers. But should the need arise, this bill does allow for Minnesota Housing to maintain some flexibility in order to adapt to ever-changing housing and financial markets. The language includes a waiver that allows the agency to adapt to market conditions year-round and more immediately should shorter timeframes be more suitable for a specific project or the housing market. The previous bill was scheduled for last week, so Alan Arthur is doing double duty today. Alan Arthur is the president and CEO of Aon, who will further highlight Minnesota's affordable housing needs and why we can't afford to wait any longer to enact policy changes and funding increases. I'm thankful for Alan's continued passion and dedication to affordable housing and grateful he was able to take time out of his busy day to join us again. Thank you to the chair, committee members, for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 1574. And thank you again to Representative Hornstein. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, and we'll have Mr. Arthur join us at the table.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for having me again, putting up with me again. I appreciate it. I don't think I need to go into great detail about how important home is in our lives. I think that's probably pretty clear to all of us, that if we lost that, it would have a tremendous negative impact on us. So from a human standpoint, from a family standpoint, for those seniors who are on fixed income, for those families who are making that minimum wage job salary, of which about 17% of our households do in the state, or that $15 an hour salary, which about 35% of folks' households do in our state, or that salary that qualifies them for affordable housing, which approaching 50% of the households make in our state. For those families, I think we know how important home is to them, and because we know what it means to us. I won't go over the trends that are leading to our current significantly increasing problem. We always have a 100-year viewpoint for the housing we create because that's our purpose. That's why we were created in 1986, and we consider ourselves a 100-year organization, and we'll do our part to try to make this important asset of home available for people for the next 100 years. It's not only up to us, though. It's up to cities, counties, states, and all of you to help make that happen. So permanent affordability does matter. As a matter of fact, as I think just was recently said, many states actually put on 50-year requirements on their affordable housing. But besides the human and social impact and importance of this extension, there's an economic, practical economic reason for it. Our communities, the state of Minnesota, our counties and our cities put significant money into the creation of affordable housing, make a significant investment, and it's absurd that we throw that away by not requiring a longer term tenure for the affordability. To say that after 15 years it's okay just to walk away with that money is a ludicrous place to be for a state that I hope intends to be reasonably fiscally prudent. And so for both the human reasons as well as the fiscal prudence reasons, I suggest that we should support this today and continue to fight to make affordable housing, keep affordable housing affordable for a longer period of time. And I'd be happy to answer any technical questions you might have about how we do that to the best of our abilities and how we work with you and others to make it happen.
And Representative Hornstein, I think in your testimony you said you compared this to the challenge program, which that was a Representative Gunther bill that we've heard in this committee already, that that is a 30-year length of time. So
correct.
This would be similar to the requirement there. I have no questions. So I think your motion is just to lay it over for possible
correct.
Inclusion. So we're keeping it here in the committee.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and I also want to thank the Homes for All Coalition and Ms. Johnson. It's an incredible effort that they have undertaken, and I appreciate all of her great work as well as Mr. Arthur's.
And any other further comments?
This is very, very important looking further into the future. You know, this region is growing, and we are only going to have more pressures, as Mr. Arthur had mentioned, on affordability, and so this is an excellent way to, you know, ensure that for the long term, you know, we'll be able to ensure these investments last.
So this is just laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
And we're going on now to, she just walked into the room just in time, Representative Herr, House File 2273.
Thank you.
And if you'd like your testifiers to just join you at the table, that would facilitate.
Perfect. And I just have one testifier. Two testifiers, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Senator, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to make a motion to move House File 2273 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Please continue.
All right. So House File 2273 is actually a solution for something that is a complex situation. So maybe it'll help if I just give a little bit of background information regarding this particular situation. So Minnesota issues both tax-exempt bonds and low-income housing tax credits on behalf of the federal government. And while these are federally authorized funds, the states are empowered to determine how they are best utilized in their state. So in Minnesota, we use a process called the Qualified Application Plan to determine which communities and which projects will receive these federally authorized funds. And last year, the legislature made a last-minute change that was not vetted in any committees and opted to kick the authority back to Congress, removing any ability for legislatures or the executive branch to institute Minnesota-specific priorities or criteria to ensure these dollars met our needs. So What this bill does is that it simply restores the authority that Minnesota Housing has had for decades to institute state-specific priorities and cost reasonableness into their decision-making. And so what I'd like to do is, because it is a really complex situation and there might be a lot of questions, I'm going to limit what I say, and I'm going to turn this over to Ellen, who will provide some more information about this, and then we'll move to the next testifier, and we'll move quickly because we know we don't have a lot of time. So,
well,
Ellen,
you can and please identify yourself.
I'm Ellen Solly, president of the Family Housing Fund, and today I'm here representing the Family Housing Fund and my colleague Warren Hansen from the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. And together, the two organizations help communities throughout Minnesota meet their affordable housing needs. And complementing the investments that you have made, the two housing funds have invested more than $500 million of private capital in housing throughout the state of Minnesota. And so on behalf of the two housing funds, I speak in support of House File 2273. Mr. Hansen and I appeared in front of this committee in mid-January as this committee started your work. And at the time, we talked about ways in which we are working to advance solutions to the housing challenges that we are facing throughout the state. And as you know, and as you've heard today, every community in Minnesota has a housing challenge. They look a little bit different depending on what community you're in, but this is impacting every community throughout the state. And that's why House File 2273 is so important. This bill restores the ability for the state of Minnesota to establish state priorities in how it spends limited federal low-income housing tax credits. This bill eliminates the troublesome language in the Minnesota statute and restores, among other things, Minnesota Housing's ability to use cost reasonableness as a basis for selection. Why does that matter? Well, to state the obvious, we have a significant housing shortage throughout the state, and we need every dollar to build as much housing as possible. Minnesota Housing needs the ability and the flexibility to reject housing development applications that are too expensive to construct. The housing community cannot reasonably argue for more housing investment if we lack the authority to make good financial decisions with the resources that this body allocates. House File 2273 allows Minnesota Housing to be a good steward of limited government resources, a duty that they have as a public body and, quite frankly, that you all expect. Thank you, Madam Chairman and members, for the opportunity to address you today.
Do we have one further testifier?
Yes, good morning, Representative Hudson. My name is Ann Smedic. I'm a senior attorney with Minnesota Housing. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm here today to also express support for House File 2273. As previously indicated, House File 2273 removes some concerning language regarding the federal low-income housing tax credit program that was inserted into Minnesota Housing statute by an amendment to the omnibus bill in the waning hours of last year's legislative session. The language imposed restrictions on what Minnesota Housing could impose in its plan for allocating federal low-income housing tax credits. The language limited the agency's ability to evaluate certain developments and includes a prohibition on the agency's ability to review cost reasonableness of some affordable housing developments. Now, the federal tax credit program is an important affordable housing resource in the state of Minnesota. To give you a bit of context, for the year 2019, Minnesota Housing awarded more than $12 million in 9% federal tax credits, and sub-allocators awarded more than $4 million in tax credits. Now, that's an important number, but the true importance of tax credits are the private equity that they generate. So the $12 million in 9% tax credits that the agency awarded for 2019 is expected to generate approximately $110 million in investment in affordable housing in the state. Now, the federal tax credit program is governed by the federal tax code. It includes detailed requirements regarding what must and can be included in the state's qualified allocation plan, including preferences and selection criteria. Now, we are the primary state allocator for these resources. We are required to award those resources pursuant to a qualified allocation plan that complies with federal law. If tax credits are awarded in a way that do not comply with federal law, they're subject to recapture by the federal government. Now, the language that was inserted at the end of the last legislative session was concerning in a number of respects, not the least of which is that it did not comply with the federal requirements that govern the federal tax credit program. We appreciate this committee for considering this bill to ensure the state is able to continue to utilize this important resource to create and preserve affordable housing in the state. I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
We have any questions? I don't think we have any questions. I think if the author would like to make any concluding comments, this is laid over for possible inclusion.
Yes, and just that I appreciate the committee listening, and this is an important thing for us to do and to move forward. And so I look forward to, if anybody has any questions later on, to answer any questions they may have regarding this complex issue. So,
just takes us back. So this is laid over for possible
thing.
And now we have Representative Howard with 2017. Does he know this thing? Representative Howard, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2017 and make a motion for re-referral to the Commerce Committee.
Okay. And you have a testifier joining you at the
yes.
table. Please present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is a good follow-up to the conversation we've been having on manufactured home parks, and seeks to make changes to allow for more resources into the trust fund to help Minnesotans who are displaced. And as we've already had a discussion that's happening in communities across the state, as I understand, the trust fund is set at $1 million, and because of the situation at Lowry Grove and otherwise across the state, that trust fund has been close to being used up. So this bill would allow for a cap to make sure that trust fund can be utilized going forward to help relocate Minnesotans who are displaced when their homes are redeveloped. And I'll turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Kitzberger, to share any more information.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dan Kitzberger. I'm the Legislative Director with Minnesota Housing, and thank you to the members of the committee and for Representative Howard for carrying this bill. This is the governor's policy bill for Minnesota Housing for this year. So the bill, as Representative Howard mentioned, makes a number of changes to statute that has to do with manufactured home park closures, specifically the Manufactured Home Park Relocation Trust Fund. And really these are changes that are aimed at doing three things. One is fixing issues related to timing. We also want to provide more advanced and clear notice to residents and other affected entities in the event of a park closure or conversion. And we also want to streamline the process for residents to receive assistance and provide some greater flexibility. So I'll just walk through the bill and the changes that are proposed. They're relatively straightforward, but I can also provide some context where needed. So in Section 1 on line 1.7, this extends the minimum notice of park conversion from 9 to 12 months. And then on line 1.17, this extends the deadline for residents to vacate from 60 to 90 days after the required public hearing is held. And then on line 1.21 to 2.22, this requires that closure notices issued more than 24 months in advance must contain a closure date. And then it requires closure statements to be reissued if a park does not close within 24 months of that initial statement. Sections 2 and 3, those replace anywhere the word municipality appears, that changes to local government entity, simply for the reason that not all parks are located in a municipality. We wanted to recognize that. That continues into Section 4, and then also as part of Section 4, and lines 3.10 to lines to 3.13. So this makes the local government authority responsible for determining if there was an ordinance in effect prior to May 26 of 2007, which is when this was originally enacted. And that's to provide compensation to displaced residents. So we currently ask them for this. We as the agency currently ask them for this information. And they are also, so it just removes a step in the process, and they also facilitate the public hearing process and identify a neutral third party to act as paymaster and arbitrator in the event of a closure. And then in Section 5 on line 4.19, as Representative Howard mentioned briefly, this raises the maximum balance of the fund from $1 million to $3 million, just due to the fact that a number of closures recently have put a lot of pressure on it. And then in Section 6 on line 5.11, this increases the current allowable relocation radius from 25 to 50 miles of a closed park and does so without raising the maximum relocation cost for households that receive funds. And then on lines 6.1 to 6.3, this allows for manufactured homeowners applying for assistance to only provide a statement from a park owner that rent is current, rather than both the statement of current rent and documentation that the $15 payment has been made to the trust fund. And then finally, on lines 7.17 to 7.19, this just corresponds to that change in Section 4 that makes the local government authority responsible for determining the ordinance and just strikes the language about the agency being responsible for that. So that's basically the summary of the bill, and I'll be happy to try and answer any questions if there are any.
I believe we have Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to confirm that when Commissioner Ho was here, we talked a bit, just touched on the issue that the management of this money for the trust fund had kind of come apart. I'll just make that as polite a way of saying it as I can. And she had set a commitment that there would be either systems and or efforts to have it come back together, be well accounted for, and be continuous in terms of its management.
Mr. Kitzberger.
Madam Chair, Representative Salk, that's a polite way of putting it. Currently, MMB administers the collection and disbursement of those funds. That is something we're continuing to work with them on longer term, whether or not they remain the home for this fund into the future. I think for the near term, I think that's where it's going to be, but I think longer term, that's something that we'll probably end up reevaluating at some point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think we have no further questions. If you have some concluding comments, and then I understand you'll change your motion a bit.
I thank you for the chance to hear this bill, and I do want to remake my motion, but to re-refer this bill to the Committee on Ways and Means.
It came from Ways and Means, so we have to send it back there before it goes to Commerce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your support.
Okay. No further questions. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, that is on its way back to Ways and Means. And we have another Representative Herbill. Right. And a couple of testifiers to join you there. Not an issue. Not a problem. Would you like to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1918 to be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division.
And then you further have an author's amendment.
Yes, I do. I have author's amendment H1918A1 amendment.
Get the bill before us. Any further explanation about the amendment?
No, and it's just for the amendment is actually just to add state facility as defined in Section 24.650, so it's just giving clarity to the current language, so it doesn't substantially change in any way.
Author's amendment is before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That author's amendment is adopted to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So before you is House File 1918. This bill would allow for the termination of lease prior to the original end date if the resident needs to move into a medical care facility. The resident would need to provide a medical certification from a medical professional as well as 2 months' notice. And so just to give a little bit of background, because I know we're really short on time, but just that Minnesota tenants in the middle of a term lease that right now they can get out of or break the lease for a handful of reasons. That includes victims of certain forms of violence. If they are called up for active active military service, if a tenant household dies, and if the building is condemned or otherwise unlivable, or and then rarely is it ever because of a judge's order, but that could be one of them. And so really all we're doing is we're adding one more, and that is for a medical condition. Tenants can only break the lease if they have a medical professional. So a doctor has to sign off on this and then state in writing that the tenant has a condition which warrants breaking the contract. Additionally, the tenant can only use the statute to break the lease if they are moving to a medical care facility, defined in statute as a nursing home, hospice care, boarding care, supervised living facility, or assisted living facility, an accessible unit, or a facility providing intensive residential rehabilitation mental health treatment services. And so what I'd like to do is, with that sort of background, I'm going to turn this over to my testifier to provide a little bit of information, and then we'll take any questions that you might have.
And is this Christopher Spade?
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Samuel Spade. I'm an attorney at Homeline. I'm also Homeline's research director. I've been practicing landlord-tenant law since 2009. I've advised personally around 15,000 residential tenants in Minnesota. Homeline is a couple of things, but one of the things is a tenant hotline. This tenant hotline was founded in 1992, and since its founding has advised over 230,000 tenants. As Representative Hurd said, there's currently no state law that would allow a tenant to end their lease early in the case of some type of medical issue. This is a reason that people call us. Break leases in general are trying to end their lease early is a reason tenants call us, and this is one of the specific subcategories. It comes up often when there is some type of new medical issue or disability. For example, the tenant may have had a stroke that requires them to have much more significant, maybe even in-home care, or perhaps a long-standing medical illness has become much worse, again requiring greater care of some kind. We take these calls regularly. I take these calls regularly. Our current advice to tenants, and these are difficult calls to have, is that they simply have to hope their landlord will work with them or maybe get lucky and re-rent the place quickly. Otherwise, the tenants are in a very difficult situation where they may have to choose between staying in a home that doesn't provide their medical necessities, or leaving, perhaps even breaking their lease to go to a place that does, and risk the financial consequences. As Representative Hurst said, this is a conservative bill. It only applies in some very specific situations. The tenant would have to give 2 months' notice, pay rent during that time. They would have to have a medical professional's written documentation of their infirmity, and that documentation would also have to show that they had been accepted as a resident at a place that the medical professional has said will count, or had applied and had a pending application there. Again, this would be to help those tenants who are struggling with this issue. And again, as someone who takes these calls, I can tell you that they're difficult conversations to have, to talk with someone who already has a lot of medical issues, a lot of other problems, or sometimes even family members who are dealing with this as an authorized representative. Making these choices, it's not easy, and I would urge the committee to pass this bill. Thank you.
And there's one other person who's asked to testify, John Reynolds. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, John Reynolds with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We are working on setting up a meeting with Representative Hurd to discuss some concerns in greater detail, and we look forward to talking to her about that. We just, this is obviously a well-intentioned bill. We just have some concerns about the technical aspects and the execution of it. Infirmity or disability that requires a long-term or permanent relocation is covered by an accommodation request under the Federal Fair Housing Law. So our members are familiar with that process. They understand that. So this would be something quite new to them. Also, the scope of the triggers that would allow for break lease is a little bit broader than I think what we would normally consider infirmity. For instance, it includes some short-term inpatient treatment that may last as short as a couple of weeks. It also, I think the Chapter 144 includes somebody deemed a health threat because they've intentionally inflicted other people with a disease. So, again, I think the bill is well-intended, just there's some scope issues that we'd like to discuss with Representative Herr when there's time. We also think that there's some timing issues. If you look at line 3.3, one of the requirements would be to show that the tenant has been accepted as a resident or has a pending application at a location at a medical facility. Our question is, what happens if the pending application doesn't actually result in acceptance or the unit's not available for a certain period of time? That puts the tenant and the landlord then in a bad spot, potentially. Our members have experienced this firsthand, so the bill would allow an authorized representative of the tenant to act on behalf of a tenant who's seeking to break the lease. Our members have experienced situations where a family member has misrepresented themselves to the landlord, and not to say that this would be allowed under bill, I'm just giving an example of some potential issues that we've run into. A family member has gone to the landlord and said, hey, Pop's not doing so well. We're really looking at some options for long-term care, nursing home, assisted living. I think we need to break lease, and our members negotiate and work with them to find a solution. And then it turns out that Pop had no idea that the son or daughter was advocating for the son's behalf and says, I don't want to go, but the lease has been broken. And the unit's been remarketed and re-rented. So there's just some execution aspects. And then for when there's no for when there's a dispute over the request, there's not a clear process in the bill for resolving that dispute. So there's just some executional aspects here that we'd love to talk to Representative Herr about, and we appreciate the committee's time.
And it is going from here to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law, so that conversation. So you don't oppose the termination of lease upon infirmity if there is language that assures medical.
Well, I think there's a scope of concerns that we'd love to discuss between here and the next committee stop with the author.
And does either the author or the other testifier, Mr. Spade, want to respond to any of that?
In general,
Spade.
Sorry, thank you, Madam Chair. In general, this wouldn't be covered under disability law, and again, many of these things might not be disabilities, might be other medical issues. I don't believe it would allow for short term. I might be mistaken there. I believe that if you look at the list of the medical facilities, there are things like hospice, assisted living, state hospitals. And again, to the final point that people might somehow have a family member or something come in and get them out of the lease, this is exactly what that bill would prevent. It requires the medical professional, requires an authorized representative, et cetera.
And I did just want to add one thing, Madam Chair, that and though I appreciate, I would be more than willing to work with anyone and maybe tightening up some of this language, but I just do want to point out that I feel like this is already actually quite conservative in what it's trying to ask for. I'm just thinking about, like, from cultural communities in which, like, we would never put, like, in the Hmong community, we would never put a loved one who needs ongoing medical care into a facility, and this doesn't allow me to be able to do that even if my family becomes incapacitated. Because I'm going to be caring for them at home, this would never even allow me to break that lease in order to do that. So I feel like this is already quite conservative in what it's asking to allow people to do, and that there are large swaths of people, considering the diversity of our communities here, that this actually doesn't allow that to happen. And so I would love to have further conversation, but knowing that, you know, there are, if we are going to address those types of things, we need to also then address the fact that there are cultural things and there are also religious or there are also, values-oriented things within families in which this actually doesn't allow them to do some of those things. And so I would love to have further conversation around that.
And, Mr. Spade, what I understand from you is it would not be your intention either to have short-term infirmity, and you do that by defining where those, what those medical care facilities are, those that they're defined in.
And Madam Chair, those medical facilities are actually defined, and so like we mentioned earlier, they're actually pretty clear about what those particular facilities are, and there are not short-term types of facilities in there, and so, but we will absolutely, I'm actually open to having further conversations around this.
We have, he's not here right now. Pardon me? Another amendment. Okay. I was just going to go to the amendment, but where the author of that amendment is, has stepped out right now, I think. So anything further to the, oh, we've got questions. Representative Pearson, sorry.
No problem.
Not looking at my little.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what in my mind is still the unanswered question that's in my mind, and Representative Herr, again, the cultural sensitivities, I certainly understand that, and certainly nothing precludes someone from being moved out of the property, just breaking the lease, whether that contract can be broken. That's a distinction I think that's worth making, because we all have the freedom to move, and we all have the freedom to do that. You're in a contract, though, and so under what terms are we willing to tell the landlord who has that contract that we're going to say your tenant can move out under these terms? And so I my real question goes back to what Mr. Reynolds was saying about the reasonable accommodations that are covered under fair housing. These are the author is stating that these are some pretty significant medical infirmities. I mean, I don't think pregnancy would even be included in this because they wouldn't necessarily move. But I bring that up. I had a three-story building in downtown Rochester, and I found out just a couple of months after my tenant moved in that they were expecting, and they had a loss in the past. And so they asked if they could break their lease. And, of course, I did just accommodate that just because, you know, good landlords do that type of thing. We work with people. But this wouldn't be, number one, this wouldn't cover that, I'm assuming. And I guess I'd like to start by getting that question answered.
Representative Herr or to Mr. Spade?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, like a pregnancy, a short term would not be covered under this. It's actually in the definitions, and then what's termination upon, it lists pretty clearly what some of these things are, and that is not included in that.
Well, Madam Chair, of course, depending on who you ask, pregnancies aren't always, they don't feel short term to some people, I know, I'm told. But the specifically on that, again, it's the typical law school type of answer. It depends, I imagine, too, because if that pregnant person was needing to stay at a facility where they were being attended to, as I think referenced in some of your cross-reference subdivisions here, where they needed to be in the hospital, hospitalized with their pregnancy for a few months or 4 months or 5 months, depending on the circumstance. In that situation, would that allow the circumstance to break lease?
Representative Herr, Mr. Spade.
Representative, Madam Counsel, two things. First, to go back to a former point, the financial considerations are very important for tenants. I have definitely talked with tenants who are considering not moving, living in these conditions because they are too afraid of the financial consequences that might follow them. To answer the most recent question, I'm sure you could conduct some hypothetical in which pregnancy might lead to a medical condition that would allow you to break the lease. It would have to be one of those medical conditions. It wouldn't be the pregnancy itself. And again, as a practical matter, having talked with many of these tenants over the years, I've never heard that raised as an issue. This is raised by tenants who have very serious medical issues who are generally going for the rest of their life into some type of assisted living or senior living facility or hospice or something along those lines.
Follow-up?
Well, thank you. And that encapsulates kind of the crux of the point, I guess. in the concept that, again, the fair housing has some limitations and reasonable accommodations for that. I don't know if Mr. Reynolds can speak. Again, where's this dividing line that this statute is so required or necessary as to, you know, supersede what's required on the federal fair housing rules currently for reasonable accommodations?
Well, Mr. Reynolds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Pearson's point, not necessarily for pregnancy, but a range of issues that may occur for renters. If you look online 1.12 to 1.13, I don't think we don't normally in statute or federal law consider pregnancy a disability, but disability here is defined as any condition or characteristic that is a physical, sensory, or mental impairment that materially limits one or more major life activity. So that would cover a range of conditions that may be quite short of a stroke or something that we would normally consider infirmity or incapacitation. And then also, if you look, and I'm sorry, I just didn't have this marked. On page 2, line 18 and 19, this is the first clause that would allow break lease, require assistance with instrumental activities of daily living or personal activities of daily living due to medical reasons or disability. I think the interesting thing about this clause is that we normally find it in state statute in the DHS chapters where somebody is actually being kept in or where we're working to keep an individual in place in their home. The state is facilitating a service to somebody so that they can stay in place. But that is also quite broad. And disability comes into play down on line 2.22. Again, I think Representative Pearson mentioned, like I discussed earlier, I'd be happy to share this with the author of the committee. There's a lot of literature out there discussing how the Federal Fair Housing Act requires accommodations in circumstances that we would normally consider infirmity.
I do hear, the bill author and the testifier, that you're very clear. All you're doing is adding a permanent condition, infirmity, that no longer allows them, they would not be capable of continuing to live in that apartment, and they're moving to one of these other facilities which you list in the bill, and that's your intention. Members, we have the other committee coming in. I'm very sorry about this, but we may need to lay this over until after we're coming.
Could just really briefly, I think one of the issues is it would be substance abuse treatment would be covered under this, so that could be something as short as 2 weeks of inpatient treatment. That's something we can work with.
Before we return at the end of the day, we'll conclude this one later today, and then we have one remaining bill. Representative Hassan will get to that one then. We are in recess until 6:30. Room 400 North.